Thank you all for coming. Thanks, Johanna, and thank you to Book Passage and to my family who's all here. I think for the first time everybody's here to one of my talks, which is rare, but it's wonderful. And thank you all for coming. There's a lot of sectors in my life that are represented here, so it's terrific. And I think I want you all to meet each other because you are all doing incredible work on your own. So hopefully maybe afterwards you have a chance to chat a little bit. So I thought I had an hour and a half or more tonight. I only have an hour, maybe a little over, so I'm going to try and keep it short. The way I see it is I'll tell the story of the book. I'll tell a little bit about the background, how it came to be. I'll talk about the topics that I covered in the book. There's some short readings. We'll see. I'm going to try and keep them real brief. And then we'll have Q&A. So I'm hoping we have the last 20 minutes or so for a lively discussion about that. And then we'll wrap up. So the background of this latest book, which just came out in May, really the genesis of Thriving Beyond Sustainability happened when I started researching this book, The Sustainability Revolution, because in that book, I was doing a master's program at New College of California, and this was 1998, and I started researching for my master's thesis. The idea was to figure out, you know, what am I going to write about? What's my big project going to be? And so I had two ideas. One was there was a book called Stuff, which some of you I know this book, which traced kind of the life cycle of tomatoes, of coffee beans, of newspapers, from the initial, you know, for the tomato, it was like, how did the farmer grow the tomato? Then it was packaged to the grocery store. Then it was trucked all the way to Toronto to a restaurant. Then it was ordered by somebody in a restaurant. Then they were eating that hamburger that had that tomato. What's the story of that? So it's all of the life cycle stuff around that. That was one idea. But the other idea was that I kept coming across sustainability principles. And this is really important because this is at the bedrock of this movement, which is about what are the values in this conversation. And so I researched that, and I wanted to write about the values, but I also wanted to write about the people doing the work. And my advisor at the time said, you know, the values is a master's. If you combine that with what people are doing, that's a PhD, and this is just a master's program, so forget that. Leave it for later. So I did. So this is the honorary PhD right there. And so the values that came up in the sustainability revolution were things like stewardship, respect for limits, you know, what are the thresholds of living systems? We can see it in climate change. We can see it in terms of water use. And things like nature as model and teacher, which is really about Janine Benyus's work in biomimicry. And I wanted to look at these values, these principles in different sectors, in sustainable communities, in green business, in green building, in environmental conservation groups. Okay, so then that was completed. I gave a few tiny examples, Gaviotas, which is a community in Colombia that's implementing some of these ideas. But then came the time to write about, to focus on the individuals and the organizations and the work that's going on out there. There is so much work going on out there, it's hard to keep track of it. And it also changes by the minute. But I think there's value in doing a slice in time, because it gives us the context of the different work that's happening in the different fields, in green building, in green business, in environmental groups, in municipalities, and even at the global level, like the UN and other organizations. So that's what I wanted to do, with the intention of inspiring people who want to read about these things. And then at the end of each chapter, I have a section on taking action, which is really the importance of seeing that, oh, it's not these great people doing this work in Asia and in Sweden, a lot of them here in the Bay Area, but also what can I do in my job? What can I do in my home? How can I do it with my friends? The day-to-day stuff. So at the end of each chapter, I go for simple things that each of us can do to take action. So David Orr, in the blurb for this book, I think really hit it on the nose when he said it's grounded hope and practical inspiration. That really spoke to me, because it really is about grounded hope, and then what can we do practically to do that? And then by the end, I discovered that a lot of these ideas and these actions and these initiatives, there are some themes there. And the themes in there is what I came up with, which is called the spirals framework, and I'll talk about that later. So I wrote the introduction at the end because I wanted to see what came out after I wrote each of the chapters. And the theme that came to me at the end was islands. And it reminded me of David Brower, you know, Earth Island Institute. It reminded me of Bucky Fuller, Spaceship Earth, this notion of an island, and then the notion that, you know, I'm from Chile originally, and I had an opportunity to visit Easter Island, and Easter Island has had a lot of, you know, collapse. Jared Diamond has spoken about it, in terms of a microcosm of what could happen to the Earth if we don't, if we follow the current track and don't shift. And for those of you not familiar, what happened essentially was that they exploited their resources to the point where they ran out. Trees, marine life, and so what happened was that they got into a desperate situation. There was a civil war, there was cannibalism on Easter Island, and they prayed to these gods. They're called Moais, which are their religious gods. And the one interesting thing is that all these gods face inward, and their history was written in these tablets, wooden tablets. And when when it was discovered by Western society, almost all of these tablets were burned. People didn't know what it was, so they were all burned. So there's just a couple that were left, and one is in the London Museum and a few others. And from that, they were able to kind of decipher some of what happened. So that's one island. But then go almost 9,000 miles northeast of there, and there's Samsø Island, and that's in off of Denmark. And that's the, you know, if Easter Island is the depressing, then Samsø Island is the hopeful island, because about 10 years ago, the Danish government approached the people there. And this island historically had been a gathering place for Vikings. And they said, okay, we want to have a competition, a contest to see, and we want to give you some funding to see if you can become self-sufficient on your island. It's about 4,000 people, I believe. And so they started installing solar and wind and distributive energy and biogas, and they did it. And they were really, really successful. So successful that they actually export extra energy to mainland Denmark. So that's sort of the positive side of how a community in an island gets together. And finally, and the bigger scale, it's Earth Island, the Earth, because we're all connected. The issues don't know political boundaries. So we got to figure out how to survive and thrive in on our Earth island. And the issues that are coming around, I view them as, I use the term the confluence, which is really five rivers that are coming together. These are global trends that are affecting us right now. The first one is ecosystem decline, which is all about the loss of biodiversity, the habitat loss, which is driven by consumption and other factors. Then there's energy transition, which we're in the middle of it. How do we switch from fossil fuels to renewable energy? And, you know, oil is not going to go away. It's just going to become extremely expensive. It's going to get to the point where it's going to make it, you know, we saw a little bit of that a few years ago when the price of gas shot up, and all of a sudden we really started thinking about how much we were going to drive, when we were going to drive, all of these issues. So that's number two. Number three is population. Population growth, we're at 6.8 billion today, and we're expected to reach about 9 billion. That's humongous impact in terms of resources. And the birth rates are up, the death rates are down because of technology, and we're living longer. And there's this thing called the demographic momentum, which is sort of built in societies. It's like the baby boomers. So this bubble of people of childbearing age for women that is, we're in, it's sort of like a wave that just ripples across. We're in that now, and that's going to manifest itself in the next 10 to 20 years. And most of it is in the developing world, right? Because in the developed world, where we've managed a lot of it because of education to keep the birth rates down. In some countries, it's actually going down. So that's three. Fourth is economic disparity. And this is really the poverty ratio. And Thomas Homer Dixon, who's a fantastic author, he wrote a book called The Upside of Down, which is fabulous. He had these statistics that kind of blew me away when I first read that. He says, in 1950, there were two rich people to one poor person. Now, I guess he's using UN data in terms of, you know, assessing what rich and poor are, but the ratio there is, again, 2 to 1. Today, in 2010, it's 4 to 1. And in 2050, in 40 years, it'll be 6 to 1. That's the projection. So when you think about that, you realize, you know, it's the haves and have-nots. The gap in that is going to be tremendous, and we're already seeing it in terms of the migrations from northern Africa to Europe, Mexico to the U.S., also Southeast Asia to Australia and other countries. So this is, again, just a function of needs. So that's number four. And finally, it's climate change. And the thing about climate change for me is that we're not good as humans to assess things that happen slowly and unequally, you know? Like, we just had the flood in Pakistan. We had the flooding in Ladakh. I don't know if you read in the news, but about 2 weeks ago, Russia has had a really poor crop yield for wheat, and they've decided that they're not going to export food this year. So it makes me realize that if the breadbaskets of the world, the U.S., Canada, Russia, other countries, India, have bad crop yields and they have to feed their own people because they just can't export, what does that mean for the rest of us, for the rest of us on the planet, and how do we cope with that? Given that those trends are here with us, I decided to start the book by looking at indigenous cultures. I'd had some experience traveling and spending time with the nomads in Tibet, and that's how this book came about. And why? I mean, so I started to look at four basic cultures: the Tibetan, the Inuits, the Balinese, and the Koji tribe. Koji tribe is in Colombia, and they were the only tribe that was not conquered by the Spaniards. It's an amazing story. Alan Herrera was the first Westerner to make contact with the Koji in the early 90s. He wrote a book called The Elder Brothers. He made a documentary in the BBC. All of this stuff came out in the early 90s, and then the book is out of print. The movie hasn't been shown since. I still have a VHS copy of it, but it's coming back. It's coming back. I think he's making another movie, and there's a bunch of websites on it. Because there's a lot of traditional knowledge, in ethnographic terms, traditional ecological knowledge or traditional knowledge. We don't have to necessarily reinvent the wheel. We have to just figure out how to readapt what they've learned over millennia into today's culture. Things like animal migrations, weather patterns that they're familiar with, governance structures. You know, in Tibet, they had laws, the satsigs, they call them, laws, hundreds, thousands of years ago, where they said, you need to protect the birds, you need to protect the species, coming down from the hierarchy, is a theocracy at that point. But again, they realized the importance of protecting their species and had these laws. It's also very much in the Buddhist culture to do that as well. But then it hit me, you know, one of the introduction to that book is, why care about Tibet? Why should it matter to us here in Marin County in 2010 about Tibet or about the Koji tribes? So far away, it seems so distant. Well, in the case of Tibet, they have the Tibetan Plateau, 15,000 feet elevation, very harsh climate. It's the size of Europe, of Western Europe. It's a huge span of land. The deforestation that the Chinese have conducted there has actually altered the weather patterns that is affecting the whole world. The deforestation that has gone on there, and they've curtailed that, because remember the floods about 6 or so years ago, there were massive floods because of the deforestation that happened in Tibet. There are 7 major rivers that come out of there. The Brahmaputra, the Yangtze, the Yellow, the Irrawaddy, and others, and they all feed into Southeast Asia and into China. Millions, actually up to 1 billion people are dependent on this for irrigation, for water use. So what happens in the Tibetan Plateau will affect us here. Another example of that is, even in China, there are studies now that are preliminary, but they're showing that one of the theories of why sudden oak death is happening in California is actually that the acid rain coming over from China is affecting the acidity of the soil, which is helping to kill the oaks. You know, that seems radical, but there's some people who are actually looking at that as a cause for it. Because it's people who have looked back at this area in the Bay Area have noticed that the shellfish, Shell Mound in Berkeley and other places, that was used by the native peoples who lived in the bay to make the soil less acid, to make it more alkaline. And it's things like that. And there was actually a lot of nurturance that went into maintaining the oaks. If you want to learn a lot about that, there's a website called Sudden Oak Life. .com, I think it is. And there's a person down in Big Sur that's done all the study. Roger Waters at San Domenico School has also done a lot of work on that, and he's doing a lot of work on the oak trees there at that school. Anyway, so the other piece of the nomads is the yak, how they dependent on the yak for cheese, for yogurt, for butter, for milk, shelter, clothing, transportation, all these things. And I was thinking this morning about this talk going, what is our modern day yak? Is it the bicycle? Is it the hybrid car? Well, no, because that's just transportation. I think it's a resilient community, and I'll talk about resiliency later, but I think it's really about each of us, really, because it's how we come together and help each other out in terms of food, energy, transportation, education, all the things that we need to have a thriving and resilient community. So I'm realizing about the time here, so I'm going to have to cut some of what I want to tell you, but let's just start with going glocal. I use the term glocal to talk about sustainable communities because it comes from a Japanese term, which is really about acting locally and thinking globally. And they came up with this years ago. And I think it's really important to think of our communities not as isolated and not as completely dependent, but a little bit of both. Everyone's talking right now about what does a resilient community mean. Well, the first thing about it is to begin to understand the basic things that make it work. Where do we get our water from? Where do we get our food? Where do we get our energy? It's also about tracking the dollars. Willits up in Sonoma started this about 5 years ago, where they started to say they wanted to figure out the dollars spent, where it goes. They also were concerned that if the Safeway truck didn't show up for a week because of oil or whatever reason, this is again when oil was really, gas was really spiking up and down, they said, what do we do? You know, what if the one grocery store runs out of food? How do we survive? So they really started looking at food production. How much food can they produce? Where does their energy come from? Where does their water come from? And a lot of that meant getting to know their neighbors and figuring out what the skill sets are of the people. Because that's really where it's at. And it's not necessarily, it's almost like a barter economy. Mark Lakeman did the same thing in Portland when he wanted to get, you know, he did city repair project to get neighbors to get to know each other at intersections. He said, okay, we're going to draw a map, but this is going to be a map about skill sets. This is going to be a map about what your profession is, what your skills, what you like to do, and how that can help your neighbor and the other person in the neighbor. So then they had this whole map of all the skill sets of all the community. And Mark Lakeman did it for Portland. And the thing that happened in Portland is now in over 150 cities all over the country. So it's nice how it's spread. So I give one example that I'm going to talk about a little bit in terms of communities, and one more story, which is Salmon Nation. Salmon Nation is a concept that was started by Spencer Beebe. Spencer Beebe is the executive director of a group up in Portland called EcoTrust. Maybe some of you know or have heard about it. EcoTrust had done a lot of work in protecting forests, protecting communities, and one of the things that Spencer wanted to do was to figure out how to engage